Welcome to the Dastan Goy podcast, a collective exploration of Pakistani history and culture.
In this episode of Dastan Goy podcast, we get to sit down with Zirak Ahmed, the founder of musical newsletter Hamnawa. Zirak looks at the different perspectives of diaspora and the evolution of their narratives. We also get to discuss the music industry in Pakistan as a whole, touching upon both the past and the present sides to it. So let's get straight to Zirak.
I grew up in Lahore, moved to the US to start college, and got into software pretty early. But then over time, my interest in software sort of gave way to interest in slightly more human aspects of using technology or the sort of creative output of technology. And so at the moment, that's taken two forms, which is either, you mentioned Hamnawa, so writing about music, sort of software work that I'm doing on the side. But basically, I think for me, the interest is trying to identify, how technology enables different forms of human production, and to be able to really serve what other people are trying to do. So that's kind of my day job also, which I think I share with you, which is trying to figure out how people use technology and then building around it. So there's a fairly shared set of motivations between all of these pieces of work.
I'd love to kind of understand your interest of music and how that can have an effect on changing or affecting the population and how it can bring us forward.
The idea of looking at music as a way of creative production, the same way as technology is creative production, and to try to identify the sort of structure with which it's put together, the people that it's put together for, the tools that are available to do it, right? And so, for example, there's a thing that I used to not write about very much before, but I do so now, which is like, what technology are we using to make the music? What technology are we using to distribute the music, and what impact that has on the people that are producing it? So really interesting transition now is this sort of transition to hip hop that's happening now in Pakistan. And I mean, it's been there around for before, but a lot more new hip hop artists now. Right. And so for me, that is intricately related to the availability of studios, to the availability of drum kits, to the availability of reaching broader audiences that are interested in hip hop elsewhere, to getting more hip hop being heard via YouTube. And so the structure of influences that a person in their 20s or in their teen years now gets in the Pakistani market is very different from what used to happen 20 years ago. And so does that fundamentally change the kind of music that's being produced? For me, yes. And so I think for me, the interest in writing about all this stuff is using this as a way of tracing all of those transitions that are happening. So there was a time when English music was considered disingenuous from being produced in Pakistan, right? And I think we've reached a point now where my question is why? Because if people across the world can produce English music and become popular globally, is there a reason why Pakistanis can't do that? Is there a reason why that cannot represent a Pakistani audience? And so asking, challenging questions like that is more interesting to me. And so I'm not interested in the music as being like, this is a good song, this is a bad song. I'm trying to sort of explain what's happening and who the people are to be able to create sort of larger storylines. And so that's a sort of archival exercise for me as much as it is a sort of, creative exercise in enjoying the music.
Like, and it's amazing because you're able to contextualize what's happening in Pakistan, right? And the way you kind of mentioned hip hop, like, it's hip hop in the West was a movement. And now we're seeing that movement happening in Pakistan. You're right. Like, there's a lot of younger kids and they're really good coming on the scene and they're producing this. It's also the democratization of technology and more people getting data plans and more people getting access to the softwares on iPhones, and you can put beats on iPhones or iPads or whatever else you may use. It's fascinating for me to look at subcultures that come out when you kind of start dissecting music. Like, hip hop kyun aa raha hai Pakistan mein? Is it just because people are listening to it? Is it just because there's a mainstream sneaker culture and hip hop that's being put out and everyone is listening to Travis Scott? Or is this actually intertwined in what's happening in Pakistan and the actual underpinnings of the different narratives that are being played out in the culture, in society, in politics. Like, what is, you know, happening that is leading to this? And I'd love to kind of hear, like, some of the themes that have been most interesting to you, other than hip hop as well, because the way you kind of contextualize it is super interesting to see. Like, for instance, just recently, the email that you sent out, which was for Sakalban, and looking at how you spoke about, you know, electronic music might not have been mainstreamed, but then bringing the pop angle and getting people to understand what Misha is saying, and then the actual poetry element, and then putting the element of electronic music, which alone might be very difficult to understand, but I think Rake and Mughli Funk are phenomenal in what they do, and getting more people to kind of understand that, it's beautiful. So I'd love to understand where your thought processes kind of come from to be able to, you know, write and to put that out.
For me, the thought process is very simple, which is to say, can I contextualize it in something broader? And more often than not, the answer is no. So I have to talk to people to figure out what's happening. There's a few stories of artists that have been around longer. So I'm sometimes accused of writing about too many people that produced music too long ago. Accusation is a strong word.
Is that a bad thing?
No, it definitely not. I think... Well, I certainly don't think so. I still write about them. So there's a few different angles. So there's a few people that have been around for a while that I enjoy writing about because of you can see a story develop. And so part of the reason why you get interested in art is because you begin to find representations of yourself, and you can find representations of yourself not just in the art itself, but also in the journey of the artists that are representing it. And so the longer people have been around, the longer you can begin to see a story unfold. And so for some of the bands that have been around for 2 or 3 decades, for shows that have happened for a while. So Coke Studio, I've been writing about for many, many years. And so for me, being able to study the transition of some of those things, to see the creative decisions that are happening, sort of help you ascertain the creative decisions that you're making in your work. And so I think those are interesting ones to follow. And then there's newer music where, there may not be as much to as yet learn or to be able to gather about a particular song. So if a new artist that maybe has released, you know, a song or two or three songs that I don't know much about, I don't have anything educating anything particularly informative to say about one particular song, but then you can begin to contextualize it in something larger. So some of the emails I sent are, you know, one line saying the song is good and that's it. And that's because I don't have much more to say beyond that. So I think that's, and then over time, you know, that relationship develops. And so as the artist, for example, reads something or you learn more about them, you begin to kind of add slightly more layers. And for me, the interesting thing has been how many people respond back with stories of their own. And so a lot of the list now is people engaging with certain content and me kind of reacting to what's happening. So it's an interesting exercise in community building.
So on that point, I'd love to hear, you know, what has been some of the feedback? How do people resonate with the way you contextualize, and what are some of the most interesting, like, or unexpected questions, feedback, stuff that you've heard from people from releasing Hum Noah?
I mean, one of the most interesting things for me is that people have artists that they want to read about, which is a pretty natural inclination, but there's a lot of the readers I interact with. Abira Kamran is a great artist and who's been sort of a great supporter for Hum Noah, writes back pretty frequently. And so she'll often be like, you know, hey, write about this person or write about, you know, the latest Coke Studio. And so for me, that's a really sort of important signal as to what people are interested in hearing. There have been requests, for example, to like write about Ali Azmat, which I haven't written about yet. I find that quite interesting that some of the sort of bigger names, people still want to kind of read about them because it's, you know, you're interested in, it's like the exercise of, I don't know if you heard about this, but people who read movie reviews after having watched a movie, you know, as a way of contextualizing what they've seen. And I feel like that's the same sort of thing that happens here. And then there's also, discovering music that people might not have found. My friend Shahan often writes back with, you know, strange YouTube clips of songs that I've never heard of before. And so he's often sent live versions, but he sent this recent Urdu cover of The Cranberry Zombie, which I had just no recollection of ever releasing. It was great. And that really, you know, resonated with people because it's just one of those things that, I mean, many people had seen it, but many had not. And so when you see it, you're like, you know, it sort of grabs your attention a little bit. And so finding little sort of obscure songs here and there that people haven't heard that are still of interest, or making them of interest by writing something on top of them. Those bits are particularly fun.
You know, it's amazing to hear that. One, for sure, the newsletter has been great for contextualizing and understanding culture and the way you kind of dissect it. And I think the way you're talking about people kind of reaching out to you and wanting your perspective, also because you're leveraging what you know and your experiences, and that's what you're kind of really coming out with and giving out, right? So when someone asks you about Ali Azmat, there Ali Azmat ke baare mein to bahut likhi hui cheez hai. You can Google him and find a lot. But the beauty of it is it's getting the perspective that you're building, right? And kind of understand the way you kind of break it down. It's, for me, it's very easy to understand. And it's a very interesting kind of way of looking at it and breaking things down. So to get that is for sure great. And also, you know, one of the things that I think you mentioned in your newsletter and I found super fascinating was also like there was an influx of pop music in the 80s and the 90s. Uske baad, I don't remember many kind of, you know, I grew up in the Junoon phase, Vital Signs, Strings. I remember those guys. But then there wasn't anything, or maybe I shifted, but I didn't notice anything coming out from Pakistan. But now we're seeing that again. And what I'd be curious to kind of learn from you would be the importance of these bigger institutions that are bringing out artists and giving them a platform. And why hasn't that happened more for individuals? Because now a younger generation, the guys who are doing, you know, like the guys like Hassan Rahim and all of these other people that are coming out, they're using YouTube and they're leveraging that and they're making their own names. They're not going to EMCs and they're not going to whatever else production houses there are. So what happened in that time period and how relevant and important a place holder of distribution have Coke Studios and Pepsi Battle of the Bands and Nescafe Basements become? And why do you think, in your opinion, that shift happened?
I think the answer is just where people in charge want to put their money and whether they're interested in new stuff. And so more and more, the more I dig into this, the more it becomes clear that in a sense, what people hear about, especially what diaspora hears about, and I think that is the lens from which both you and I are looking at this, which I think is a significantly different lens from what people in Pakistan are looking at it from. And so we should separate the two. So more often than not, what diaspora hears about is directly related to when diaspora left, because those are the sort of moments that are put into history. And so oftentimes the big cultural moments are linked to the big exoduses from, you know, outward from Pakistan elsewhere. So that's kind of one part of it. And I think the second part is related to both essentially distribution mechanism, which is a function of both business and technology. And so the 90s, there was a great show called Music Channel Charts, which was run by a man named Ghazan Farali, who actively seeked out new music. And so every week he would say, let's find new people to put on the show. So there was this sort of burgeoning scene that, of course, you know, did not single-handedly create, but gave distribution support for, and that has to come top down. And as many corporate structures work, you need some sort of top down support to enable broad institutional shifts like this. So Ghazan Farali is the same guy that starts Indus Music in the early 2000s.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then a number of other music channels pop up, all of which are now computing and finding who is the best sort of new bands that are coming out. The first season of Battle of the Bands starts around this time, Pepsi invests in it. So there's this sort of burgeoning scene, after which a number of things happen that have hit the scene poorly. So concerts not happening really hit the sort of economic structure of the scene. Piracy was always the huge issue, and every effort that came around to try to fix it didn't really work. Geo started to try to start this big record label that didn't work. And so the whole ecosystem of artists trusting record labels was sort of shaky to begin with. Then we had a number of bans of various platforms on the internet. And so what was, as the internet was becoming the primary distribution mechanism for culture all over the world, we decided to go out of our way to prevent that from going anywhere, coupled with the fact that you couldn't have lots of live shows, meant that, you know, the infrastructure became a little bit more insular. And so that disconnected diaspora even more. So if you look back at the last 10 years, a lot of great music was produced, but less people have heard about it because you had to, you know, be in the city or be in a show or be in a small gathering. And so a lot of bands with very dedicated smaller followings have started, which is not a problem because lots of bands with dedicated small followings started many great scenes across the world. But you can find a number of different shows and sort of efforts to restart this over the last many years that didn't work. So there's this great little series called Lesson TV that was started by the Karachi kind of rock scene. I think now the Shahzad was a big part of that, who runs Sikandar Kamandar. And so that started around the time when like YouTube was being shut down. And so, you know, these sorts of efforts were hit kind of in the knees really early. And so, you know, what we're doing right now is not different from what has happened kind of before. Some of these things catch on, some of these things don't. So I think it's a function very much of everything else that's going on around at the same time.
You know, I had completely forgotten that YouTube was banned in Pakistan. So that's a massive issue for sure. Lekin ab agar isi ko censorship ko dekha jaye, and we do see that on films, we do see that. I would say we see that sometimes on music as well, and what you can and cannot say. How much of an effect can that have? And to this day and age as well, where like, you know, a couple of months ago, TikTok was supposed to be banned, if I'm not mistaken. So these outlets do get banned. So how do you still have an output of creativity? How do you still get into production? And how do you support institutions? Like for instance, in France, they have a fund that helps, you know, filmmakers go into the government, and they're able to get very easily able to get grants, and you know, it's the society helps you. In Pakistan, those structures, from my understanding, don't exist. I'd love to kind of hear if you know of structures like that, either governmental or other institutions that have, you know, like a fund or some kind of support system to bring up new talent. We have the NCAs and stuff like that for artists, but what about musicians? Do we, like you said earlier, there is more access to recording studios. We don't have as many, I don't know of a university or a place where people can go and learn music and get into it or understand what it takes to, you know, pick up an instrument. But our culture has also been like, if you go to Gilgit Baltistan, like, you know, you can still get courses around the rabab and different instruments like that. So there are music schools, and music has been like very intertwined, especially because of doing stuff with Coast Studio. I'm starting to understand more about ustads and classical music and how, you know, that culture still exists. What about the new kind of stuff that's going on? Do you see a support system for that? Or is it still just like the 1-2% of people that are super motivated that are able to kind of break that boundary and get the help that they need?
I haven't lived in Lahore for over a decade. And so maybe I'm not the best person to answer this question. Perhaps, you know, musicians in the scene may best be able to answer what sort of networks of support they receive. But I think there is an interesting parallel into the some other infrastructural issues that both artists and technologists face. And so this PayPal conversation has been going for many, many years now, where both software people and artists of various kinds and freelancers are interested in being able to receive digital payments from abroad, which is a way that has enabled a lot of people to start making a living online. Patreon is connected to PayPal. And so there's an interview on the Masiki podcast of the band Tuk-a-Tuk, who had now have a Patreon. And so they're beginning to generate some money from it. And so there was a big question of how did you get a Patreon? And they're like, we know a guy who has a PayPal. And so I think that is emblematic of a lot of infrastructural issues that plague many creative industries, including music. And so, which is not to say that there aren't individuals that don't find a way out, because a lot of people do find a way out and find a sponsor or find a, by sponsor, I mean, not just a corporate sponsor, but an institutional sponsor or individual sponsor that helps them get their work across. But for just sort of, you know, someone going in to make a living out of doing this stuff, it's not really that easy. And so I think that probably is a good explanation for why most of the pop music, at least the stuff that I write about, is not necessarily made by full-time musicians, but people that have, at least at some point, some point in their life, dabbled in other stuff or go back and forth. Because I think that infrastructure requires that sort of engagement.
Got it. Who would be some of the most interesting artists or themes that you're seeing, that you're interested in writing about or exploring more about right now?
That's interesting. It's a good question. Dula Siddiqui is really good, really interesting person to talk to, because his span of work in so short a time is very interesting. And so for me, I'm not very well versed in the genealogy of music that sort of Abdullah and a lot of the people that are producing music around him have necessarily heard. And so I know the kind of rock music genealogy pretty well, but this one I'm just sort of learning to build. So I think that's of the new folks, you know, he's definitely a really interesting person to talk to. Manu is a really interesting person to talk to. In fact, he had a recent interview on TPR, the TPR podcast. And so that was really interesting. Abdurrahman, who runs Masiki, has kind of done a lot of work to build kind of sort of distribution infrastructure, at least in a writing sense and publishing sense, with a lot of indie musicians. So he'd be a great person to talk to. You know, some of the older guys that have been running big production enterprises. So Bilal Maqsood, obviously sort of, you know, one of the pillars of the industry. Zulfi has really been part of creating a lot of infrastructure over the last 20 years or so, but is sort of his contribution is less well known. So he's a really interesting person to talk to. Mikal Hassan, who has produced a number of artists and produces a lot of people that are not kind of directly linked to him in the public sphere, is very probably very interesting to talk to. I'll keep thinking of more as we go on.
It's super interesting. I'd like to break down and to understand and what's, you know, the different kind of spheres of culture that affect. And then also seeing the new kind of inspirations or experiences or the new kinds of music. I mean, most recently, there was a psychedelic video that you put up and you sent over. And I saw that, I was like, wow, like I have never seen nor experienced this. And I did not know that that kind of stuff existed. And for me, to be honest, like, again, like I told you, like, you know, Dastango is a very selfish endeavor. And it's people like yourselves that, you know, like, that are super interesting to kind of understand and get a perspective on music. Because musically, like I said, like we were, you know, very disconnected. But it also gives you a very interesting lens on the land and on, you know, the issues and the people and the things that people are celebrating, the things that, you know, that are happening. And for me, like, I remember when we were doing Coke Studio and I was speaking to, I think, Zara, who's the assistant producer for Coke Studio. And she was telling me about how they go about exploring new themes and doing research around what they want to speak about. And then we were kind of discussing the themes that came out of last year. And if we kind of look at the songs that came out from Coke Studio for this year, they were all about resilience and, you know, women empowerment and love and being able to live in the moment and live in today. It's really fascinating for me to see how important music is in people, and the effect that it has, in human nature, in everyday life, in the way we look at the world, and especially in a time like last year, and I mean, continuing on this year, and how everything is kind of, you know, panning out and playing out. You need some kind of, you need something to be happy. I mean, not something to be happy. I mean, I hope everyone is happy like the way they are, but something, you know, that kind of brings joy in one way, shape, or form. And I really think music has the ability to kind of, you know, bring people together, and do that. And then I think like jamming, I mean, the idea of jamming, I mean, again, I'm not a musician. I don't know anything about it as much as, you know, I like to hear about it. I like to understand the underpinnings. I like to understand the narratives that go around making things as much as a story, you know, being told. Because I think truly music is a story. If you start to look into the lyrics and if you start to look into how it kind of came together, I think it really exemplifies and showcases that we can still come together no matter the circumstances, be able to produce something that's beautiful and something that's meaningful. And to me, it's just so important to be able to understand the underpinnings. And something like what you do with Hamnawa allows us to do that, allows me to do that. And for that, I am super grateful. At the end of
that's
the
very kind of you. I will challenge that a little bit, which is that some of my favorite music is like Dr. Obilla.
Who's that?
You've not heard Dr. Obilla?
No.
Dr. Obilla is, for lack of a better term, they are a parody act, but they are not a parody act.
Okay.
I think of them as something completely genuine and original, because the parody act implies that you are making fun of something, but they are not, they are being who they are. So they produce, you know, music that is completely frivolous, has no meaning, and all it does is make you laugh. But genuinely, like from a musical standpoint, like fairly, like really solid, like it's not a joke. And so my favorite song of theirs is a song called Jin, which has the chorus, Hai Manu Jin Pega. Is there a meaning to the song? Does it capture anything societally? No, it's a bunch of people having fun. And I think the challenge for people, especially my age and especially for diaspora, is attaching meaning to things when, as a way of sort of going through our journey, when it may not necessarily be deserving of it. By deserving, I don't mean to say that, you know, something, this is not a value judgment. This is just saying sometimes frivolousness is a good cause.
So
Shamoon's music is great, right? So like this is a complete blind spot in my musical listening. I didn't listen to Shamoon for a long time. And then there's, you know, if you go look at Shamoon's YouTube channel, it's crazy. Like people really love his music. You can go listen to the words.
This is Shamoon Ismail, right?
You know, yeah. You know, the words in Shamoon's music are not talking about like broad societal themes. It is, you know, it's stuff that teenagers go through, or people or young people go through. And it's just that's all there is to it. It's just fun lines being said over catchy beats in, you know, hummable melodies. And it's great. People love it. And if you see, you know, videos of Shamoon performing, it is amazing. Just the way that people are able to get into it. And so I think there is, while I definitely am interested in the, you know, music that is with words that are attempting to say something, or with cultures that are being preserved in some sort of new form, or where they're the underlying structure of the music, or the tradition that is leading to its production is interesting. Sometimes there isn't that genealogy, and that's fine also.
And that's completely fine.
I'm interested in that also. And so for me, those ones are, it's more interesting to write about who's listening to that music and why they're listening to it, and what somebody listened to be able to produce it. And so I think that at least from the standpoint of diaspora, that is something that gets missed quite a bit. And for people that write about Pakistan, especially about Pakistani technology and culture, they're all part of diaspora. And I'm extending the definition of diaspora, not just to mean people that migrated from Pakistan and now live abroad and their descendants, but also people that have some connection to something abroad. So students that went to study abroad and came back, or people that work for a foreign client or freelancers, all of these are basically people that are connected to a foreign cultural existence. And so this entire infrastructure looks for sort of deep meaning and progress when people really just want to live their lives. And so I think for me, that is the challenge also, which is to say, how do we best represent just like normal being, normal life for a lot of people that are not, they don't care about these themes.
You know,
and I think that is a perfectly valid existence.
I completely agree with you. And I think I fall in that category a lot.
And so
something that I've been discussing with people of late is also, why do we have to look at Pakistan in a nostalgic way, or in a way of preserving or looking forward?
Because for us, that is a central force.
It is. Har roz ki zindagi bhi to hoti hai, and you're able to celebrate that, right? Like, I don't need to find meaning in every single part of my day. But
yeah, I think there is, for me, sorry, I'm talking over you. I want to validate both sides of the experience. There's the diaspora experience that is dealing with this culture from a point of separation. Either that they have been separated from it and don't feel as connected as they should, or for people like me who remember sort of one moment when we used to be there and are now engaging it from a distance, and so have to engage this newfound distance and have to learn to deal with it. It's a very valid experience. And so for us, being able to find an audience, being able to like preserve certain things, find people that have similar experiences or shared experiences, that is a perfectly valid and underserved cultural desire. And so I think, like, for example, like the British diaspora, like rap scene, like the Punjabi rap scene in the UK represents a different social reality than the sort of South Asian immigrants in the UAE or South Asian immigrants in the US from a different time. And so cultural traditions for a lot of these diaspora bodies have not been built. And so we are just learning ourselves to figure out how to do it. And similarly, there is a, school going kids in Pakistan now have a sort of culture that is not particularly well represented in films or movies or music. And so any representation that they find of it, they sort of will attach to. And I think for, you know, Shamoon, for example, is a representation of that is the way it connects to them in a way that it does not connect to people that are 10 years older than kids that are going to school or college in Pakistan right now. So I think there's also a point of everybody that is doing their cultural production to sort of understand their limits, right? So the theme of immigration is now very relevant to my work. I think in a sense, my audience is limited to people that have this diaspora transition that they're dealing with as well. And so do I speak to someone that has lived in Pakistan all their life and does not care about these issues? Probably not. That's fine. You know, that's not it's not an audience that I can serve. And so somebody else may need to go serve that audience. So I think there is a question of recognizing who you are in this position, what role you have to serve. And that has been an important transition for me to be able to, you know, connect with other people in diaspora as well. So there's a moment when you migrate that you begin to realize that the other people that migrated with you and are in the same place as you are living a life that is closer to you than the people that you left behind. It's a very important transition to make and a very hard one to make, because I think you find yourself in this sort of new transplanted reality with people that you don't necessarily find something in common with, but actually have a lot more in common with. And so reflecting that reality in the creative output that we produce and helping people be able to make that transition, I think is an important goal. And so that's, for me, that is also the sort of journey that I am having with this writing and hopefully making it easier for other people to kind of come to terms with it.
I love that. Like, I think that's a very important point that you've made. Kafi dafa, we do overstep, and we think that our way or our understanding of, you know, a particular place or a particular time is the only understanding of a particular place or a particular time. And also, I can see this, the way you reference things in your writing. It's very obvious the way you kind of, you know, segment things, and it's beautiful. And you know, the way you mentioned like the rap scene in the UK or stuff in the UAE, I really think that there, as long as you're able to let go of your preconception, like preconceived notions, and when people start to figure out that they are disconnected and finally kind of find that moment where you come to terms with that, there's a way of adding, because you're culturally becoming something different. You're becoming a little pod of your own. And that's not to say that you're less or more, it's something different. It's a new journey altogether. And that it, on its own is something super fascinating, right? Like the way you're talking about like the younger generation, like Pakistan, my mean average age is like 23 years old. I can't relate to that, man, I'm 31. So I can't physically or in any way be able to understand the reality of that young kid going to school, of 80% of the 60, 70% of the population going to school right now, 23, 24 years old, like they're very young. So, but that does not make their reality any less important, any less real to what culture, quote unquote, kind of represents out of Pakistan or outside of Pakistan. There are kids who are in the UAE who are 15, 20 years old. They go back. I mean, case in point, when I used to go back to Pakistan when I was a young kid, I would not be able to relate. Because culturally we're different. That doesn't mean that, you know, I'm less of or they're less of or whatever. It's about being able to understand this is that boundary, or like just the moment that you said, okay, having the ability and the awareness, the physical awareness to be able to say, okay, I am now changed. My path has changed. And how do you converge? I mean, you might not be able to converge, but to realize that that adds to your personality, not does not take it away. You don't become any less of a person.
I think this goes very much to our earlier point of how do you, build products or, cultural products for people that have not been well understood, right? There's a fundamental need for empathy in this situation. And that begins with understanding your own position in that environment. So say, for example, if I am building software that I am hoping that my parents are able to use, you have to be able to say, okay, what is my job here? My job is to understand what is holding them back from using this technology. My job is to understand what it is that motivates them, whether or not they're going to use technology in a certain way. In cultural output, I think it's the same way, which is to say, what is my role in this position? What role can I best serve? Who is best served to support some sort of goal? And so then identifying what role you can play. So for me, I think, there's a number of structural elements that come into play in my writing, which is that I don't have access to a lot of primary sources. I have more access now than I used to before, but I don't talk to a lot of artists directly. And so a lot of the times when I'm writing about the music, I'm not interviewing people. I am going off of sources that people that have talked to them already and then sort of recontextualizing it. So I'm sourcing a lot of other people's writing and a lot of other people's material that I learn a lot from. I am far away, so I don't have the sort of physical presence that a lot of people have. And so I write from that standpoint. So I'm never going to be able to write a question of like, what's it like to listen to this music live? That's not the role that I'm serving, which is fine. If, I see them live, I'm going to write about it. But so I think that acknowledging where you can push allows you to be the kind of best version of whatever it is that you are attempting to do. So I think that is when I've gone to the structure of my writing a little bit more. There's a lot of self-referentialism in my writing, more so now than it used to be. I write in very abstract terms, but now I think as you read my writing, you can get a sense of kind of who I am and what I'm attempting to do. And that's primarily not as meant to be a description of myself, but as a way of contextualizing where my read of whatever I'm writing about is coming from. So that if somebody else was writing about it, that would be a little bit different. And so it's always fun when other people send stuff over to send out to the list, because then it's a completely different way of looking at the same things. So I enjoyed that quite a bit.
Zirek, in one of the things you mentioned, I'd be curious to kind of, I know that we're running very late, but I want to kind of understand in the age and the day that we're living in right now, right? Like you're in Seattle, I'm in Dubai right now. Live music events technically are not happening. It's all happening online. How, in your opinion, does it affect people coming online and, you know, it becoming a center stage, jahan pe hum Janoon ke concerts pe jaate the bachpan mein, if those concerts start to come online and if those experiences start to come online, does that then, how do you think that then affects the diaspora living outside looking in? I mean, it's still not the same experience whatsoever, but you're at least able to kind of then say that you've heard them live, right? Like just that thing that you said, I wanted to kind of just dive deep into that, the live element and the interactive, like the ability to interact. Like for instance, when you do the Sangui events and we get all these people to come online, if you look at the list of people, they're from France, Italy, Canada, Toronto, Toronto, Canada, some parts of the US, in the UAE, and they're all interacting at that same moment. And in that one moment, you are experiencing everything together. And there's this sense of oneness, which at least I found, I mean, when I look at the chats and when I read everything in those live events, I think it's spectacular because bringing everyone together, like you can only talk about a particular aspect because you're sitting outside. I can only talk about a particular aspect because I've only experienced something. But there is this fine line and this beauty of being able to not know one another. I mean, concerts may be up, like you don't know the next person majority of the times, but to be able to interact with people together across the world and your own experiences and the stuff that kind of comes out from, you know, the receiving end or the audience's end is amazing. And I never knew that. I never thought about that until we did the first event. And for me, that was mind-blowing because for the first time, I was sitting in a room with people from all over the world listening to and experiencing the same exact thing. So when Zeb Bangash sings a Thumri live on, I mean, you know, it's pixelated. Sure, you're limited by technology, but people from India are commenting. People from Canada are commenting. People from Dubai are commenting. People from Pakistan are commenting. And at that moment, you're all one. You know, you're not that person in, you know, whoever your day is or whatever your thing is. At that one moment, you're all experiencing and you're all interacting in that same way. What do you think that that's something that can continue on going forward or be relevant after this pandemic and after this kind of like online world that we're living in? Or do you still think the relevance of, you know, sitting down live is, I mean, having it in like a little, in a concert hall or someone's house is still the most important thing?
I mean, in the 60s, the Beatles got sick of touring and then started making music that they on purpose would not be able to play live. So they started messing around with like backwards guitar solos or, you know, getting an orchestra to play one song really crazily and in a way that they would never be able to play these things live. And that was driven by the fact that they were sick of playing live because they couldn't hear themselves because people were yelling at them all the time. And so part of what was great about the stuff that they did was that they took the failures of the medium that they were stuck with and turned that into a constraint and then found whatever this new constraint enabled them to do and really pushed hard in that direction. And so for me, the interesting movements are always how are new forms being pushed to not replicate old cultural practice, yeah, but to do something different in a way that I find Ali Hamza and Ali Sethi's virtual presences very interesting. So Ali Hamza has been doing a lot of sort of recordings that are, you know, he does a kind of live concert of sorts that he streams live, and he does a lot of songs that people want to listen to, and there's not many recordings of it, so people really into it, but it's sort of, you know, it's replicating a concert setting online. Meanwhile, Ali Sethi is doing this complete different like request show on Instagram, you know, talking to people that show up into his chat, pulling them over, singing half a song, then not singing half a song in a frame that you can't really see anything, the lighting is not that good, now you can't even see his instrument. And he's like, please, you know, doesn't play full songs, will mess around a little bit more. But that has gotten, I think from, if I'm reading this correctly, a lot more traction. And so, and do I think one form is better than another? No, I mean, you know, who am I to pass that value judgment? And I imagine both will live on in some form, but I find Ali Sethi's format much more interesting because it is
it's more intimate.
A new kind. It's a different kind of interaction. I mean, I'm not even, I think without even going into the characteristics of what makes it good, just the fact that it is attempting to do something new enables a different kind of interaction.
True.
And so you are now more likely to hear him sing a song that he's sung before. You are more likely to hear him sing a song that he will never sing again. You are more likely to find other people making jokes and him cracking a joke with someone in a way that you are not likely to see in a kind of sort of live concert performance. So the energy is different. The songs are different. You may want to participate. And so then, you know, there's an additional element of, I think, embedded in your question was this question of how many people are in a synchronicity and ephemerality, which is like, do you have to be experiencing the same thing at the same time? Does that thing need to live on, or does that thing need to be captured in that moment and then never seen again? Or can you, you know, have a sort of ephemeral interaction that can then be replayed later? And we're seeing that play out with lots of different social media, you know, vanishing messages, Snapchat, and, you know, moments, sorry, Instagram stories versus normal Instagram posts. Like, we're debating these things technologically because now that we have the ability to do either one, we are finding that different forms enable different kind of interaction. So the sort of stuff that you would post in stories in Instagram is very different from the sort of stuff that you would post in normal posts. And I think that same sort of negotiation is likely to happen in all of the other creative forms that we're now seeing. It's all been accelerated as a result of COVID. But I think it's quite interesting to see which way it plays out. And I don't think there are necessarily solid answers yet, especially from an artistic standpoint, on if we are certain that one form will take over another. In fact, I'm quite interested to see the various new kinds of formats of you know, at least music production, but other kinds of art as well that come out of it.
Zurich, last question for you. Could you tell me about three experiences that have changed you the most or have affected you?
Well, this will require a prep call. It's probably broad themes, less so than specific experiences. You know, I think immigration, we've talked about this already, but that's definitely an important one. The internet, I think, is central. My life has been built around the internet. Wasn't possible with or without it. All the information I've received to construct my life, all the work I've ever done has been, would never have been done without the just the presence of the internet. And I think there's the other thing that's been helpful for me is finding mentors that have encouraged me to try stupid things and to see what happens. And so the freedom to embarrass myself enough times has been useful in trying to push for some new kinds of work. So I think those have been sort of the big influences for the work that I do now.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on the Last Time Podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for listening. Please follow us on Instagram and YouTube for more stories. You can get in touch with us via email contact.dastangoy@gmail.com. Until next time, thank you, shukriya, meherbani, khudafiz.